Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am coming to you from Brussels, joined today by James Baxter, Australia's ambassador to the World Trade Organization in Geneva, and Bruegel's senior fellow, Ignacio Garcia Becerro, who is a former European Commission senior trade official and now also at Bruegel. Ignacio has been writing all about WTO, the future of the multilateral trading system, and we are so happy to have you both here today to talk about 30 years of the WTO. Ignacio, how did this happen and what does it mean?
Rebecca, what I think is very extraordinary about the WTO is that it is probably the only area of policy where everything that you do is subject to legally binding international commitments. I mean, if you look into what is the WTO, it's a set of rules that govern almost all aspects of trade policy. And it's quite simple structured. I mean, you negotiate about tariffs, you apply the same tariff to all members of the WTO unless you have concluded a trade agreement. And those tariffs are quite low, very low for OECD members, a little bit higher, but also low for China, much higher, though, for some emerging economies like India or Brazil. When it comes to behind-the-border measures, non-tariff measures, basic commitment is you should not discriminate and you should act in a transparent manner. And then you have also a number of exceptions, goods and services, and it's a rather comprehensive set of rules that applies across the board to all aspects of trade policy, and which is legally binding in the sense that if you act not in accordance with the rules, you are subject to arbitration. And if you don't comply with the outcome of an arbitration procedure with an appeal phase, then you can be subject to retaliation by your trading partners. So that's what was created the 1st of January, 1995. I would say it is something that has been working relatively well, but at the same time, it's experiencing quite a significant number of problems, and I would say at this point in time, it is suffering a very deep crisis. Now, if you look into WTO dispute settlement, since the first Trump administration, it is no longer binding because a party to a dispute has always the option to block the procedure by appealing into the void. There's no longer an appellate body, so it is possible to appeal, and at that point in time, the procedure stops. And that has been the consequence of the U.S. decision to block the appointments of members of the appellate body. Now, the rules of the WTO, in my view, continue to be relevant, but they have not been updated. These are all the rules that were negotiated in the mid-80s, early 90s, and a lot has happened since then. And the attempts to modernize the rules have basically failed. There was an attempt to have a major trade negotiation, and since 2008, that has basically stopped. So in all of these 30 years of the WTO, there have been very little that has been done in terms of modernizing the WTO rulebook. And beyond, we see how difficult it is. Let's look into some very recent examples. One of the few areas in which there has been a multilateral agreement in the WTO is fisheries subsidies. Now, a first-generation agreement was negotiated in MC12, but the attempts to reach an agreement since on the issue that were not covered initially have failed because one or two members do not agree. And because everything in the WTO needs to be decided by consensus, that means multilateral negotiations are blocked. There have been attempts to avoid this through the negotiation of plurilateral agreements, some of them with very broad participation in the Geneva, like the Investment Facilitation for Development Agreement. I think about 120 countries participate there. But again, one or two countries do not agree that this agreement should be integrated in the WTO, and therefore this agreement is somewhere in the limbo. So you have those problems about the dispute settlement is not functioning anymore, the negotiating function, it is not working. And on top of that, you have a situation in which you may be facing a founding critical member of the WTO basically deciding to ignore even the most basic rules of the WTO, that they need to abide by your tariff commitments. Now, if you put all those elements together, you have on the one hand a set of rules, which I think still makes sense, but on the other hand, a very profound and deep crisis of the institution, which really requires an effort to see how to make the WTO relevant for the new environment.
James, so what's it like on the ground?
Thanks, Rebecca. So it's pretty challenging, but it's also potentially exciting. And maybe that's an answer that surprises you. So let me expand on it a little bit. I think the way that Ignacio has set out where the organization and the rules have reached over the last 30 years is really a pretty accurate analysis. Perhaps if I can give an Australian perspective, obviously we are not one of the very large economies in the WTO, but we are, you know, Australia is a sizable economy. We're very trade exposed. What's important to us about the WTO is predictability and transparency across global markets and really giving our exporters, importers, service suppliers, the maximum choice. So we have a whole network of bilateral and regional free trade agreements, but there are some things that free trade agreements don't achieve very well. One of them is that global coherence that we have in WTO rules. So the same set of rules applying across all markets. That's something that we have in the existing WTO rules and something that is really important to us in some of the rules that we've been negotiating recently. And this is what brings me to the exciting part of the analysis for Australia. So over the last few years, groups of the membership have concluded plurilateral negotiations in areas like domestic regulation of services, in areas that are aimed at an agreement that's aimed at facilitating investment across global markets. And then importantly for us, the first global agreement on electronic commerce, which we, along with Japan and Singapore, had the privilege of leading to conclusion just this year. And you might say in 2024, it's pretty bad that there are no global rules on digital trade. And that's perhaps a sign of one of the problems the WTO faces. But actually, the fact that so many of us were able to do it shows that there is still a commitment to building these rules. And the reaction to those rules from industry has been very positive. They really appreciate the idea that you have a platform of rules that applies across markets from different regions across the world. And that's something we could not, as Australia, certainly achieve through free trade agreements, but I would even argue that the largest economies cannot do it nearly as efficiently as they can do it in the WTO. So the fact that notwithstanding the challenges that Ignacio has outlined, members, at least groups of members, are finding ways to develop rules that have these attributes and benefit stakeholders is something that is very exciting. On the challenging side, this is the bit that gets much more of the media attention, of course, and we have to be realistic. There are lots of challenges facing the organisation, and I won't repeat them. A lot relate to two areas. One is dispute settlement, and the other is decision-making and decision-making by consensus, which is particularly obstructing efforts to develop multilateral rules. Just to reinforce what Ignacio said, that for us, you know, and I think for so many members, what's crucial about the WTO, what really delivers its value, is the fact that the rules that are agreed are binding. And there was, and still is now among some members, a capacity to enforce those rules. And going back to the fact that Australia's not one of the largest members, when we're having a trade dispute with one of the largest members, we tend not to be able to rely on our economic weight to resolve the problems. But we have been able to rely on the WTO. And actually, that was reinforced for us in recent years. We've had a number of disputes with one of our largest trading partners, a much larger economy, with whom we have a free trade agreement, a very good free trade agreement. But that free trade agreement didn't help us fix the problems that we were having. And in fact, what did was the WTO. And that really reinforced the value of the organisation and the enforceability that Ignacio was talking about for us. And I think that underlies the sense of attachment that many governments still have to the system that we're talking about.
Are you referring to the dispute or challenging situation you had with China?
Indeed. We had a number of trade impediments. They were very public at the time. They were part of a broader set of difficulties in bilateral relations that inhibited the capacity for us to tackle those bilaterally in the way that we might have liked to. But they didn't. The fact that we were having bilateral difficulties did not inhibit our capacity to tackle them in the WTO, where the rules provided us with an effective remedy. And I should say, actually, because it's a two-way street, that at the same time China challenged some of our trade policies or our trade measures that it thought were inconsistent with the rules, and it did. It won. But it didn't win because it exercised political weight or economic weight against us. It won because it took us to an impartial umpire, and the impartial umpire upheld their claims.
Super interesting, and thank you for giving us a little bit more detail on the case study. As we move into the next section of the podcast, Ignacio, you mentioned the US in your sort of opening salvo, and we've also just talked about China. Can you talk about the role of those two giant economies in the WTO system? There are certainly critics of the WTO out there who've said that China's joining marked a real turning point for the organization. And as you mentioned, the US decision to effectively drop out of the appeals framework has also been pretty significant.
Rebecca, I think you are absolutely right. The United States and China are, of course, critical players in the WTO. And how they behave in the next 4 years is going to be critical to see what are the perspectives for the institution. Because the world today is very different to the world of 1995. If anything, because of the geopolitical conflict between the US and China and the implications that that has for the global trading system. Now, if you look into the US was the big promoter of the WTO. The WTO would not have happened without a strong leadership of the US. It was not only the consequence of leadership of the US. I think the European community and other players have a very important part in the creation of the WTO. But at the same time, it is clear that progressively the US has been disengaging from the WTO. This is not just the disruptive actions that started with the Trump administration. I think there has been a gradual process of disengagement from the United States on the WTO, which means that you should try to keep the United States as much as possible engaged, even with the second Trump administration, but you should not expect leadership coming from the United States. When it comes to China, I think their position on the WTO is quite interesting. China is a great beneficiary for the WTO. So they are very active in Geneva. They are very much invested in all the different activities of the WTO. But at the same time, it is clear that there are some fundamental problems about the Chinese system and how it distorts the level playing field in terms of the functioning of the WTO. And so far, China has not had really to confront those challenges, in part because no one has really been pushing into the agenda of the WTO the issues which are really difficult for China, like the revolt of subsidies, the revolt of state-owned enterprises, the fact that China should no longer consider itself as being a developing country. So are the really difficult issues, which so far, because there has not been a real push to tackle those issues in the WTO, China has been able to navigate relatively comfortably and in a very skillful manner, I have to say. All my chapeau to the diplomatic capacity of China in the WTO. Now, what I think all of this means from my point of view is that if you actually wanted to have a system that functions in what are going to be 4 very critical years, you need to build an alternative coalition for leadership. You cannot rely on leadership from the US. You cannot rely on leadership from China. And that's where I think you really need to look into an alternative coalition. I hope the European Union can be a strong promoter of that coalition, because I think all the arguments that James made why the WTO matters for Australia, in my view, could also be applicable for the European Union. I mean, the European Union has constructed this whole trade policy on the basis of respect of rules. if you are living in a world which is not rules-based, it's going to be very, very difficult for the European Union to operate. So even for these selfish reasons, it makes sense for us to try to do as much as we can to keep the system working and to give a sense of forward motion. But I don't think the European Union can do this on its own. And that's what I think is really going to be important to see, where you can invest in creating a coalition. I mean, I see, for instance, the European Union and the CPTPP countries being the logical members of that coalition. I also hope that that could be the case for most of Latin America. And I think the fact that we have concluded an agreement with Mercosur could also hopefully get Brazil actively engaged in a coalition to support forward movement in the WTO. Big challenges are going to be, what about Africa? And an even bigger challenge, what about India? But I think, in my view, if you don't start with this process of countries that really care about keeping the system functioning and getting a sense of forward movement, the next 4 years can be really be quite challenging. And what worries me most is that increasingly countries decide that the rules don't really work anymore, because the US does not respect the rules. China is also ignoring the rules, or in any case, the rules are not really very effective to deal with distortions on the Chinese system. And then if you get into this dynamic, I think you would come to a point in which the system is not relevant anymore. And I think that's going to be the big risk for the next 4 years.
James, can you remind us how the CPTPP came to being, what it stands for, and what it means to be a medium-sized economy in a world where these big powers can sometimes take up all the stage?
Sure. So the CPTPP, how it came about, it's got quite a long history. It started off with an agreement that grew out of a P4 agreement that had been concluded among four relatively small economies across the Indo-Pacific that the United States in the late 2000s, under the Obama administration, decided it would like to transform into a mega regional agreement, something that hadn't really been tried before. And it led the negotiations of that agreement, of a new agreement that was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And that was concluded in the mid-2010s. And that brought together the United States, Japan, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, a number of other countries in Southeast Asia, though not all. And it did so in the form of an agreement where both market access commitments, market opening commitments, and rules were, in trade negotiators' language, very ambitious. They were very high level. They went way beyond levels of integration that had been achieved in the WTO. And that was quite a remarkable achievement for such a large group of economies. The Trump administration famously decided that the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement was not something that was in the United States' interests, and so walked away. And then Japan and other remaining members of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement decided that they would nonetheless like to proceed with it in the absence of the United States, and renamed it the CPTPP. And that agreement has been in force for a number of years now. And it's actually grown with the very recent accession of the United Kingdom, not a country we traditionally think of as a Pacific partner, perhaps geographically, but that demonstrated the commitment, I think the aspiration of the participants to have this as an open agreement, i.e. countries that could meet the standards set in the agreement should be allowed to join. And that's a process that has attracted the interest of a number of economies around the region and beyond. The United Kingdom has now acceded. So what does that mean? You know, what does that mean for an economy such as Australia? Well, it's an extremely important development. It does offer a level of integration that we don't get from WTO rules. It offers a level of predictability and coherence across a set of markets that we don't get from bilateral free trade agreements. And that's really important for businesses, as so many of our major markets are covered in that agreement. So it's one of the vehicles we've used, along with bilateral free trade agreements and other regional free trade agreements, to complement the WTO rules that were negotiated so long ago. I should say, though, in respect of the CPTPP and our bilateral free trade agreements, they are all very much built on the WTO framework of rules. And that's one of the other indispensable values of that set of rules.
Coming back to the WTO, you guys have both been in this space for much of its lifetime. Are there any particular moments that stand out? Inessa, you mentioned once the start of the dueling complaints over aircraft subsidies that came from the US and the EU. Can you tell us about some of your memories from that time?
Well, I have been for such a long time in the GATT and in the WTO that it's a little bit difficult to choose memories.
The GATT was what? The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade? That was the predecessor to the WTO?
Yeah, the GATT was actually established in 1947. It was basically about tariffs, but also the basic rules of the WTO were already there in the GATT. The big negotiation that transformed the GATT into the WTO was the Uruguay Round negotiations, which started in 1986 until the creation of the WTO in 1995. And it was actually my first job when I joined the European Commission. So I have a lot of wonderful memories. But of course, it's very easy to have good memories of those times. First, because you were much younger. And secondly, because it was the heyday of trade multilateralism. And I have to say that my experiences about the WTO are not quite as exciting as those I have about my days when I was involved in the negotiations in the GATT. But let me give you just two memories. One is a positive one, and the other one is a very negative one. But I would like to go to recent events. I would like to go to the last two ministerial conferences, because ministerial conferences in the WTO, quite frankly, they are terribly messy and very often conclude without an outcome. So for me, one of the greatest memories of my late career in the WTO was the last day of the 12th ministerial conference, where after having faced the abyss, everything started to come together. And it was possible to reach an agreement on the continuation of the e-commerce moratorium. There were difficult discussions between the EBP Dombrovskis and the South African trade minister. Somehow, after the collapse of the negotiation on fish, this managed to resurface. And after the difficult discussion, we managed to have the first phase fishery subsidies agreement. And all of this was basically gabled, if I remember correctly, James, around 5 in the morning in Geneva, when the sun was actually beginning to rise. It was really beautiful after the end of that successful ministerial meeting to go walking through the park to your hotel saying, job good done, the WTO is back on track. So you have this wonderful sense of optimism about having been able to achieve something meaningful. And then zoom forward to a much more dislikable experience, which was the last day of the 13th ministerial conference of the WTO, the Abu Dhabi ministerial conference, where everything collapsed step by step. I mean, I was there when there was the small group discussions on agriculture, but it was clear there was no way of reconciling the different positions on the table. I was there when there was an attempt to convince India that we should be doing work in the WTO about trade and industrial policy. India said, no way, until we have delivered on our expectations on agriculture, nothing new is going to happen in the WTO. And when, despite brave attempts, the fishery subsidies negotiations also collapsed. And I remember going back to my hotel, going back to the airport with a strong sense this organization is doomed. There's no way that actually is going to be possible to get the WTO back on track. Now, a lot of time has passed since then, so I'm a little bit more optimistic now. But that gives you a sense about how challenging multilateral trade diplomacy actually is.
James, what do you remember?
I definitely remember both of those ministerial conferences. And I think the first one, Ignacio, it was concluded at that time. I think it was 1.5 days after the conference was supposed to end. So it had actually been extended on a number of times. So it was real. It was knife edge stuff, but it came out the right way. A couple of other things. So one, not on the a good moment for Australia and for me personally, it doesn't relate to a negotiation. It actually relates to dispute settlement. And that was when we successfully resisted a challenge by a number of members who were seeking to overturn measures Australia had put in place to require plain packaging of tobacco in Australia. So that was the longest single case in WTO dispute settlement history. It ran for 8 years, and extraordinary procedures had to be adopted to manage the scale of it. And in fact, it was the appellate body's last case. And really, it was a bit of a David and Goliath episode. It was Australia against four, then three, and eventually two other WTO members who had evident tobacco industry financial support, and that came through every step of the process. For Australia, it was absolutely crucial that the future of that dispute endorsed the right of members to have non-discriminatory policies that would protect human health. And that was especially important in this case because many other governments were looking to follow Australia's lead on tobacco plain packaging. Now, ultimately, that was the finding of the appellate body. And so the system was vindicated. I should say I wasn't part of our legal team defending dispute, so I can't claim credit for the tremendous work they did in the face of really unprecedentedly litigious approaches by or to WTO dispute settlement. The reason I look back on it with satisfaction is because way back in 2010 or maybe even before, I'd signed off on the advice to the Australian government saying that WTO rules would permit Australia to take the approach it eventually did. And that was really tested in the disputes. So that was a really, I think that was a great moment for the institution, notwithstanding it was the appellate body's last ruling. But it was a very satisfying one as well and an important one for Australia.
And what about airplanes, Ignacio?
You know, in a way, the airplane case is a very good example about what went wrong with WTO dispute settlement. I mean, I was engaged in the very beginning of that case because when the United States decided to abandon the bilateral agreement that we have reached to have peace in the aircraft sector, I was immediately asked that we had to be sure that we could also launch a case against the Boeing, and we were well prepared. So I was involved in the initial consultation round on the case. This being said, it's not a very satisfying experience because, in my view, it's a very good example of lawyers having totally taken over a very difficult trade policy issue that should have been solved through negotiations way, way, way before when negotiations actually happened. There was all the tricks in the game being used for the purpose of litigation. I think the litigation then took, 10 years? So if you actually want to see a good example about what was going wrong about WTO dispute settlement, I think Airbus Boeing is the perfect example about how you should not use the WTO for the purpose of litigation. So I think that, in my view, is not something I'm particularly proud. I mean, I played a little part on this at the very beginning because I was a good soldier. I was in charge of WTO dispute settlement at that point in time, and I was asked to be sure that we were prepared. But clearly, what should have happened is that after having launched the initial legal salvos, both sides should have got into negotiations, and that would have been the much more productive use both of the time of the US and the European Union and of WTO resources.
Thanks for that. As we move into the last part of our podcast, let's talk about where we should go from here. Both of you have expressed confidence that it's good to have a WTO, that it beats the alternatives of either tearing it up or starting over. So beyond a magic wand to get some of the big countries to become super enthusiastic, what can we do?
Well, if you want, Rebecca, let me just say what is the minimum that should be done by as broad coalition of countries as possible. Not sure that this would actually necessarily always bring the United States and China. Sometimes you may bring one and not the other, and you should be open to different configurations. But I think there are three things that should really be done. The first one has to do with dispute settlement. As many countries as possible should show that they are continue to be committed to a binding dispute settlement system, where it is through the expansion of the multi-party interim arbitration agreement on which both Australia and the EU are parties, but many other countries. I think an expansion of the MPIA is something that should be a priority. If some countries are not ready to join the MPIA, but are ready to take a commitment not to appeal into the void, again, that would be a useful exercise. And of course, at the same time, let's keep engagement on the multilateral process. I'm not optimistic about reaching a resolution with the current US administration, But I still think it is possible to reach a multilateral agreement. So the conversation on the multilateral discussions on dispute settlement reform should continue to be in place. Now, the second question is, James has been referring to all of these ongoing activities in Geneva on the plurilateral side. Investment facilitation for development is a no-brainer. There should really be no reason whatsoever why such an agreement cannot be integrated into the WTO. I would suggest that countries which are members of this agreement should already start the process of national ratification of the agreement. But at the same time, there should be a real dialogue at the more political level with the one or two countries which are objective to try to ensure that this objection can be solved before the next ministerial conference. I think e-commerce is going to be a little bit more challenging, and I would be interested in hearing the views of James on that. We may have different perspectives on e-commerce. It's going to be a bit more challenging, but at the very least, you should be able to get the investment facilitation for development agreement into the WTO system, or in any case, to start its implementation. And then I think we need to bear in mind that the next ministerial conference, MC14, which I think is going to be in April, if I've heard correctly, James, but please confirm, and which is going to be in Cameroon, delivers something meaningful on development. So I think we need to start thinking about what could be a development package that could be agreed by MC14. I mean, I'm not going to put here the concrete ideas on the table, but again, that would be something to show that the WTO is relevant for those developing countries which are less well integrated into global value chains. So that may be a way of looking into this also from the perspective of sustainability. So I think one should be looking into a development outcome that can be agreed by the time of NC14. Those are the bare minimum things. But at the same time, I think you also need to start other conversations on issues which should normally resonate also in the United States, not necessarily on the administration, but it's not only the administration. You also need to be looking into business, etc. And that's what I think, even if it may not be possible to achieve a lot of progress between now and the next ministerial meeting, you need to be able to see how far you can go on the issues relating to e-commerce. And I think you also need to see how far you can start conversations about the issues relating to subsidies. Now, these are an issue which can only be tackled in the WTO. I mean, it's never going to be tackled through bilateral agreements. But I think a conversation both on agricultural subsidies and industrial subsidies is something that you need to see how this can start moving forward. Not with the expectation that we can find a resolution by the next ministerial meeting. I don't think that that's likely. But at least to show that there's a process of discussion that has started and which might be interesting for also the big players to decide that they want to join.
Super interesting. James, what do you think?
So I think it's a really important question, Rebecca, and one that those of us who do attach value to the system need to be considering very carefully. And I think, you know, I really am attracted to Ignacio's approach of trying to develop some very concrete and practical things that could be pursued, because I think there is a lot of still almost sentimental attachment to the WTO on the part of the broad swathe of the membership. There's much less in the way of tackling the problems that we face beyond at times repeating approaches that have failed often multiple times in the past. So I think we've really, those of us who see the value of the system, the onus is on us, and I include Australia in that, but certainly the EU can make a material difference to the prospects of success as well because of its economic weight and political weight. You know, the onus is on us to think of practical things that can be done. And I think Ignacio has identified a number of areas that are worth consideration. I suppose a couple of observations. The first one is we have to recognise that there are likely limits to the areas where governments are prepared to tackle challenges together in a cooperative way. And I think, you know, that's a very big question mark over the coming 4 years, and we just have to be realistic about some of those things and not try to do impossible things in the WTO. I do think, though, when you're looking at some of the possible things, whether it's more plurilateral cooperation among subsets of members, There are reasons for optimism. Members are getting used to moving things along in the evolving environment. We have had, as Ignacio said, the position of the US on the organization has been shifting for some time. To be very frank, there was a shock at the beginning of 2017. And I think it took the membership some time to recover. But I think in 2025, there are a number of members who are much more comfortable with working together to identify things that can be usefully done, even in a constrained environment. That said, there are differences and in perspective about approaches that should be taken among subsets of members. There are views that the WTO's value is in its multilateral framework that applies to all members, and that departures from that are potentially problematic. That sort of thinking can apply whether it's to rulemaking or rule enforcement. And it's true even among some of those who do want to achieve outcomes at the WTO, including in areas like development. So I guess when it comes to thinking about the who as opposed to the what, one of the things that members need to work through is how to balance the level of ambition. What is it you want to achieve? Where do you want to get outcomes versus the breadth of participation? And I think that will be one of the things that we all have to keep talking to each other over the coming years. As I said, I think attitudes are shifting, but there are, I think, wide perspectives and still diverse perspectives across the membership on moving ahead in the absence of a complete member consensus to do so.
So what can Europe do? What can the EU do to help all of this move forward?
Well, I mean, the first thing, I think it would be critical that the European Union is very clear that for them, WTO reform, despite the challenging moment that we are living, continues to be a top trade policy priority. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not other issues that the European Union should be doing on trade. I don't think there is a contradiction between, on the one hand, putting a lot of efforts in trying to get the WTO moving forward and being quite active when it comes to our bilateral trade agenda. I think it's great news that we have finally been able to conclude Mercosur. I think that we should be looking into other trade agreements, maybe even into Australia, who knows? I'm joking for James. And we should be looking also in terms of how to strengthen the cooperation between the European Union and the CTPP countries. But there should be no separation between an active bilateral agenda and a WTO reform agenda, because the two issues should really go together. So for me, the critical question is going to be, is the European Union going to be ready to take risk, to try to employ its commitment to build up a coalition of countries, looking perhaps into some other trade ministers who are interested in helping in this process of building up a coalition, as I said, both to keep as much as possible the system alive between now and in the next 4 years, but also to show a certain sense of forward movement. Now, just let me give you an example of a conversation which I suspect would not be simple for the European Union, but I think that we should be ready to engage. I mentioned reform of agricultural subsidies as one of the issues that is not going to be solved in NC14, let's be realistic, but at the same time, it's going to be critical to find a way forward in the organization. And I would argue that there should be a conversation taking place between the Cairns Group, between the African Group and the European Union to see, can we agree on what could be the parameters for a reform of trade-distorting domestic support? I mean, of course, there are other players out there. There's China, there's India, there's the US. But I think if you actually have an active engagement also by the European Union on a conversation, which is not going to be a simple one, I think that's something that should contribute towards this sense of forward movement. I also think that the European Union should be ready to be very active on the discussions in the WTO about the trade and environment interface. I know that our policies are sometimes being criticized, and I think that in my view, the best response to that criticism is to show that what we are doing autonomously is not in contradiction with trying to build also, if possible, the agreements at the multilateral level or at least at the plurilateral level. So I think a lot of engagement in the WTO, but also outside the WTO on the trade and climate agenda is something which I think the European Union should be ready to do, to think creatively about what could be a development package for the NC14, where I think it's going to be very important the discussion with South Africa and with other countries in the African Union to identify what could be a potential development outcome. Again, that is going to require some degree of leadership, commitment by the European Union. And that's just a few of the examples and areas where I think that an active involvement by the EU would be important. But as I said, not on its own. I don't think that we should pretend that the EU on its own can lead. I think the EU would really need to be able to build up a coalition. I think perhaps a small group of trade ministers which are particularly active in trying to push forward this type of agenda.
James, you're up.
I really like Ignacio's idea of trying to revitalize a political commitment to not the organization itself so much, but the idea that the organization can still serve important interests for governments, because that's really what it's there to do. I think that's lacking, and I think it's understandable. The organization has not been seen as delivering on objectives that are important to governments at the moment. But it does still play a vital role, and it has, I think, suffered from neglect at the political level. And we know that it's facing, very significant challenges at the political level. And unless there is a bit of a push at the political level by those who recognise its value, then we risk further corrosion of the system. So I really like that idea. I think that it's quite feasible. I think the EU could play an indispensable leadership role in bringing together that sort of group and broadcasting that sort of message. On the environment area in particular, this is one of the dimensions where it's really important that the WTO be much better plugged in to developments, again, that are important to governments that are going on in terms of other regimes, whether it's climate or otherwise, but climate is the overwhelming one. The reality is that in various ways, trade rules and policies can have an enormous impact on emissions reductions targets that are shared globally. The idea that we're trying to get to net zero by 2015 is something that can either be promoted and facilitated or could be undermined by trade policies, depending on how they're crafted, and that the WTO shouldn't actively be taking on responsibility for addressing some of that and for helping governments address some of that seems to me something irresponsible. So I think it is an area that the organisation has started to grapple with. It's not that easy, and I think actually the discussions have progressed more in the WTO in the climate context. And that's something, again, where I think the Director General and others can continue to work to build coherence. I do think that, Ignacio is right that some of the very forward-leaning measures adopted by the EU have created some comment in the WTO, some resistance on the part of some members. But I don't think that it follows at all that the membership believes that the EU should not be pursuing emissions reduction measures that might affect trade. It's a question of how and how you design the measures and when you bring other members in and how you reconcile the different interests of different members and the extent to which you're constraining economic opportunity. You can have very good discussions about that in the WTO. You can demonstrate that this is a forum that, again, no other forum can match for helping governments come to grips with the twin goals of climate, emissions reduction and economic growth. And that's something that I think there actually, I believe, is an increasing appetite on the part of the membership to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the COP, that's the UN Climate Conference, because when the EU was getting ready to roll out its carbon border adjustment mechanism, people were not saying, how does this fit with the UN environment and the negotiations and
debate there, particularly with the effect on, you know, emerging market nations that might really be affected by this new mechanism. Instead, they were saying, is it WTO compliant? Will emerging market nations that are part of the WTO challenge it? Ignacio, should that make us hopeful that the WTO still has a place?
Well, I think it's a really difficult issue of governance, because in my view, there is a real need to have a forum somewhere where you can have a discussion about how different carbon pricing schemes can better interact between each other and how to ensure interoperability of many different types of carbon pricing schemes which are being developed by many countries. And I think that's a discussion that, in my view, needs to happen and could have potential implications for the way that the CBAM would be implemented in practice. Can you have that discussion in the WTO? I'm a little bit skeptical. I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical where you really have the expertise and the disposition in the WTO to have that type of conversation. At the same time, it's not clear either that you can have it in the COP. The COP is a very complicated type of animal. So where it is that you can actually have that conversation, for me, that's a real challenge. There's also a conversation that I think could take place at some point in time, not bilaterally, as was tried in the with the Biden administration, but in a broader set of grouping, regardless of whether you apply the carbon pricing or not, can you agree on a pathway to decarbonize some carbon-intensive sectors, like steel? I mean, again, it's a conversation which, in my view, would make a lot of sense for it to take place somewhere. Can you really do it in the WTO? I doubt it. Of course, you need to be transparent in everything that you do it, and you need to keep the WTO abreast of what is happening. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to be able to negotiate those issues in the context of the WTO. That doesn't mean that you can't do nothing in the WTO. I still think there is a potential trade and climate agenda for the WTO. I'm particularly intrigued on the development dimension, because, I mean, I think everyone would agree that there is a strong argument to further diversify the green value chains, to have more investment on developing countries on the green energy, on renewable energy, to see how this process could be supported, to help about. And maybe that could actually be a kind of conversation that you could take place in the context of the WTO and be the basis for agreeing on some form of probably plurilateral, to be realistic, plurilateral initiative that could be very for the conclusion by the time of MC14. So that's something which I see on the trade and environment, trade and climate space that you could potentially do in the WTO. There's, of course, also an issue which is a little bit more midterm, the whole issue about subsidies, to what extent when you are looking into new rules on subsidies, you need to factor into account not only impacts on trade, but also impacts on the climate. And I think it's a conversation which is, in my view, useful both when you are talking about agricultural subsidies and when you are talking about industrial subsidies. I mean, this is not for tomorrow, but insofar as there are going to be more conceptual discussions about how to advance those conversations, this is probably also something that needs to happen among groups of countries in Geneva. So there's a lot of things that can happen in Geneva, but not everything needs to happen in WTO. I think we also need to be used to the idea that we are going to be living in a world where it has to be different levels of policy governance. Some things can be done in the WTO, some things are much better being done bilaterally, plurilaterally, if necessary, outside the WTO. And it's not just one simple institutional framework where everything needs to happen.
Thank you so much. This has been The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. We are so lucky today to have with us James Baxter, the ambassador from Australia to the World Trade Organization in Geneva, and Ignacio Garcia Becerro, who was the European Union's man on the scene as part of the European Commission for a long time and is now a fellow with us at Bruegel. You can check out his writings and many others on our website, bruegel.org. You can find this podcast and its companion podcasts on all of your favorite channels. Please come see us again. Thank you for listening in, and Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us.